I'll just sit down and turn back to Genesis chapter 45. And we'll see a man there who trusted in God alone. People often say, don't they, that Christians are those who are Christians because they're weak. You ever heard that? Or maybe that allegation's been thrown at you? Actually, the only reason you're a Christian is because you're weak and because you're somebody that needs a crutch to lean on. And that's really why you have a belief in God. Because you need some kind of explanation which yields meaning and hope even through the darkest days. That's why you're a Christian, because you're a weak person. Now, there's a variety of replies you can give to that. Maybe you've got a good one. One of the ones I like to give, I hope not glibly when somebody has said that to me in the past, is better to have a crutch to keep me up than not to realize that I've fallen on my face in the first place. But in this passage of Genesis that we've come to today, chapter 45, we're going to see, I think, not so much dependence on a crutch of belief in God, but something much, much more profound. In fact, it's been illustrated, I hope you took the illustration, that I shared with the children. That before you can properly understand who God is, what he's done and what you owe him, you've got to come to that point where you are, and this is the first point in fact, where you are, if you like, brought low in order to be raised up. And that's exactly what happened to the brothers of Joseph, as we've been seeing in these last few chapters that lead us into chapter 45. They had been brought low before being able to be raised up. In other words, a recognition that they needed a crutch in the first place, if we dare to explain it in those terms, is the first step to being able to move forward. And you've got to come again to this question, because it is key to what's been happening in these last few chapters. Why on earth didn't Joseph just simply tell them at the beginning who he was? When he first saw their face, why didn't he just say, look, I'm Joseph, I'm the Prime Minister of Egypt, I'm sure you're going to be very sorry, but mostly because you're now very frightened, because I could have your heads removed just with a snap of my fingers, if you like. Why didn't he just do it like that? Or why didn't he wait until they had come back a second time and simply done it again? Why did he have to put them through all the pain and all the agony and all the grief with the silver cup in Benjamin's sack? Why did he have to wait until literally the end of chapter 44? People like Judah, who by this point would be a man in his probably 50s or 60s. Why did he have to wait until somebody like Judah wasn't at the end of his tether? You wonder that? Do you know, the tendency to ask questions like that reveals something enormous about our culture. And what it reveals, actually, is that we are locked into, as a culture, I've said this before and I'm convinced that it's true, we're locked in as a culture to an idol. And it's the idol of happiness, the idol of comfort, the idol of, I've always got a right to be okay. And the very idea that we might balk that these men have been dragged to the end of their tether reveals that we think being pushed to the end of your tether is, largely speaking, an unacceptable thing for anybody ever to have to go. And not least because we've all experienced that at some time or another. And we know, don't we, from experience, in fact, that life seldom works so that we're always happy and always healthy and always that things are going the right way. And in fact, as with the child who has to be disciplined and come to the point where they realize why what it was wrong, so that they won't do it again before they can properly say sorry, would that children always were so compliant that they understand that the first discipline I made. We know, don't we, that even through adulthood, there are times where if we're going to grow into people, and particularly grow to be mature people, and dare I say, grow to be godly people, unless we come to that point where there is nothing else to lean on but God, we will never learn to depend on him at all. Let's pick up this story in verse 3 of chapter 45 and see what happens. Joseph said to his brothers, after all that they'd been through, And after all the agony that he'd revealed in chapter 45 and the tears and so on, so loudly, it says in verse 2, that the Egyptians heard him and Pharaoh's household got to hear about it, Joseph said to his brothers, I am Joseph. Is my father still living? But his brothers were not able to answer him because they were terrified at his presence. And Joseph said to his brothers, come close to me. And when they'd done so, he said, I am your brother Joseph, the one you sold into Egypt. It doesn't take much imagination to begin to understand why they'd be terrified, does it? The last time they'd seen this guy, they'd beaten him up, torn his clothes, dropped him in a cistern, lifted it out, and made a quick buck by selling him to slave traders. Can you blame them for being terrified? Here's the man with almost total authority who has them just where he wants them, and he turns out to be the brother they beat up and sold as a slave. You don't blame them for being a bit afraid, do you? But this is the brother, the same brother, who hasn't, if they'd stopped to think for a minute, who hasn't exacted vengeance on them. This is the same brother who, though he quizzed them closely at the beginning, has referred to fear in God, and who gave them back the money that they'd spent on the first lot of grain. This is the same brother who'd helped them. This is the same brother who has brought them, more than anything else, back to God, and who has brought them through circumstances low enough to acknowledge in the previous verses in chapter 44 their guilt and sin. And now when at last Judah has said, here is Benjamin who stole your cup, though we understand not how. Here is Benjamin, take me. Only then, when Judah, who's the one whose idea it was to sell Joseph in the first place, only now that Judah has got to that point, is Joseph convinced enough to reveal who he is. Their fear is no surprise, you see. But it isn't necessary. And it isn't necessary because Joseph has already told them right back in the beginning, and he was the first one to raise it, I won't do think something that is wrong because, and he could almost have said, unlike you, I fear God. This is the same one who's seen God's hand over all his doings for the last 20 years or more, who has made sure that he has had them brought low so that they can be raised up to the same point of, this is point two, trusting the sovereign God who has blessed him over these last years. Verse 5, let's pick it up. And now he says, do not be distressed and do not be angry with yourselves for selling me here, because it was to save lives that God sent me ahead of you. For 2 years now there's been famine in the land, and for the next 5 years there will not be ploughing and reaping. But God sent me ahead of you to preserve for you a remnant on earth and to save your lives by a great deliverance. So that it was you, not you who sent me here, but God. He made me father to Pharaoh, lord of his entire household, and ruler of all Egypt. That is quite a claim to make, isn't it? Quite a claim to make. You see in the beginning of the chapter how emotional he was. So emotionally, he throws his attendants out and he weeps and cries so loudly that it builds a reputation for him in the house and amongst the slaves. And even right the way up to Buckingham Palace, the equivalent of, imagine Tony Blair blubbering in 10 Downing Street and the Queen getting to hear about it, if we can follow the same pattern. Maybe that happens. I'm not making aspersions or otherwise. I don't know. Maybe sometimes if it did, it would be a good thing to happen. And that's not a political comment either, so don't read anything into it, please. But that's the equivalent of what happened. And yet with all that emotion, he comes out with statements like verses 5 to 8. This is not simply the words of a man who's overcome with emotion, is it? This is a man who's had a long conviction and who knows what it is to walk with God. He looks at his brothers. Why aren't I going to kill you right now for what you did to me? Why aren't I at least going to see you horsewhipped? Because it wasn't you that did it, it was God. That's why. Just think what he's been through. He started in chapter 37 as the blessed and pampered favourite of Dad, so much so that he was the one who was able to come to Dad with the secret tales of what his brothers had been up to. So much so that it was he that had the brand new suit at Savile Row, or whatever the equivalent was, in the coat of many colours. The favourite of Dad. He's the one that's been beaten up as a slave, having walked all over the place and close to a quite dangerous area, we saw in chapter 37, to find his brothers. I think what that means for a moment. Dropped into the cistern, having been beaten up. Lifted out of the cistern, none too pleasantly. And then sold as a slave. Imagine what that meant. He would have had his hands tied and maybe shackles on his feet. And he would have then had not the quiet camel ride into Egypt, but the long march as a slave, maybe dragged sometimes, maybe kept short of food and certainly short of water. He had the long march into Egypt. He had plenty of time in that long march to think, I'm never going to forgive these guys. Imagine being marched the equivalent distance of from here to Manchester, which is something like the same distance, through a desert, behind a camel. Imagine the blisters on your feet. He had that to endure. And then being sold in a slave market. And then being made to work so hard. Imagine what it was like to lie down at night. Think what he'd lost. Think about his young brother Ben. And what they might do to Ben. Think about what it was like to miss Dad. Think about missing the robe. Think about missing the tent, all his stuff. Night after night, after night, after night. Then he manages to get into a house, we're told in chapter 39, where he manages to work his way up, and because he's determined to do his best, he manages to be the one that's in charge of all the other slaves, the one who was trusted, and then the unfairness of his master's wife, and then the years of imprisonment, which made the march from Egypt into Egypt looked like it was a picnic, serving the other prisoners. What was it that kept him going through all those years? What could possibly have kept him going? You see, there's no point in saying vengeance. What possible vengeance could he have exacted as a slave? Even to run away, the brothers would have caught him. He was just a slave. He'd never have managed to get back there anyway. Vengeance wouldn't have kept him going. As we've seen, as we've looked at these chapters in these last few weeks, it was a definite conviction, faith that God was God and that God would fulfill his purposes. That's what kept him going, that God never breaks his promises. And now at last, in chapter 45, as the brothers are bowing before him, as they refer to Jacob, your servant, remember in chapter 37, the dreams, the fact that the whole family was going to go bow down to him? Figuratively speaking, they all have. And Joseph can see God keeps his promises. He was right to keep going through all those years and not to give up and not to dishonor God and not to give in to his master's wife who wanted her to sleep with him and not to give in all those times when he could have just used his apparently clever ability of interpreting dreams. He could have used them purely to his profit, and he didn't. Indeed, as the years of sadness passed, Joseph could not possibly have known what the future held but the promises of God. But in terms of his role of saving many lives, he did, however, know who it was held the future. And that's true for you and me, isn't it? We don't know what the future holds all the time, but we do know who holds the future. Now, I don't know about you, I'd rather have the second than the first. Every time. Because so often, if we knew what the future was going to hold for us, sure, we'd see the good bits, hopefully, there are some good bits, but we'd also see the bad bits, and we'd shirk from them, wouldn't we? Like climbing along a mountain pass, if you like. You see the road falling away either side of you. And there are times when you would say, there's no way I'm going to walk across there. No way, unless there's somebody holding tight my hand who knows certainly where they're going. Much better to have that, isn't it, than to have a map? Verse 7, he says, God sent me ahead of you to preserve for you a remnant on earth and to save your lives by a great deliverance. So then it was not you who sent me here, but God. All those times, especially the sad and tempting times, all those times he could have, and you and I can, believe that God has forgotten or lost control or whatever. Joseph held on to the fact, as we can hold on to the fact, God is sovereign. That is the key to life. God is sovereign. If that isn't true, he isn't worth even knowing. If that is true, everything else is put into perspective. We read in Psalm 96, right at the beginning this morning, say among the nations, the Lord reigns. The world is firmly established. It cannot be moved. He will judge all the peoples with equity. The Lord reigns. That we can rest on. But there's something else here that's going on that we've got to get to grips with. You see, it's all very well seeing that the Lord was working in Joseph's life and bringing him low to raise him up to save his family, and in particular bringing, more illustratively of the process, if you like, of bringing his brothers right low so that Joseph was able to raise them up and save the family. And it's not a surprise, as we'll see in the moment, the Lord told his great-grandfather Abraham that these things were going to happen, and more. But there is another question we've got to get to grips with in these chapters that I wonder if you've thought of, and it's very relevant for us today. What about all the other people in the region who were affected by the famine? You see, this wasn't just a famine that affected the family of Joseph and Israel. This was a famine that affected the whole of Egypt and, as we've seen, the whole of the world, as they called it in that day. It went right into the Middle East. They were up in Israel. They weren't in Egypt when they experienced famine, Jacob and his family. What about all the other people? What about the Amalekites and all the rest of it? It's all very well crying out that the family of Israel might become destitute, as he did in chapter 45. But what about all the other families? And you see, that while that may sound like a merely intellectual and theological question just for us to mull over, it's not at all that. It's crucial today for what's going on in our world. As Christians, we say, that's great, isn't it? We can face the future with a certainty of what God is doing. Would you feel like that today if you were living in Pakistan? What is God doing in Pakistan? What is God doing in Mexico? What is God doing in New Orleans? Let's bring it closer to home. What's God doing in the life of a young mum with cancer? What's God doing in the life of a man with a heart condition? What is God doing in terms of redundancy when somebody faces that? Or what is God doing when it comes to losing a child or having a miscarriage or anything else that goes wrong in our world that seems to have no rhyme nor reason? And I can't see any rhyme nor reason to what's gone on in Pakistan these last week or two. What is God doing? Why could this famine happen? And we've got this tale of one family, but what about all those other families? Aren't we tempted to say? And the answer that the Bible gives may sound inadequate, but it's the only one we're given. And actually, it's a great one if you stop and think about it. Remember, here is Judah. And Judah says, there's Ben. There is Ben. Take me. 1800 years later, the greatest son of Judah, who we've seen pictured for us again and again and again in these chapters, in the life of Joseph and ultimately then in the life of Judah, having spent his whole 33 years living with a stench of sin around him, the greater son of Judah bowed down in a garden one night and he said, Father, if you're willing, take this cup from me. Yet not my will, but yours be done. an angel from heaven appeared to him to strengthen him. And being in anguish, he prayed more earnestly, and his sweat was like drops of blood falling to the ground. And as he endured the trial, and as they scourged him, and as they nailed him to the cross, and as he looked on his tormentors and prayed, "Father, forgive them, because they don't know what they're doing," and as he bore in himself all of our sin and rebellion, and God said, in effect, to a broken and sinful world, "This is how much I love you." So we've got to take him at his word, haven't we? And trust in that same Saviour, Jesus, who rose again from the dead and gives us living hope. And says the letter to the Hebrews, who did it for the joy set before him. He endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. You see, the answer that the Bible gives us when you come to what's happening in the other lives of the people in this famine, apart from the fact that many of them were fed through the blessing of God through Joseph, what about those that didn't hear that there was grain in Egypt? So it's the same answer to what happens to the inexplicable, terrible things in our world, such as famine, such as illness, and so on. The answer, actually, as we look at other people, is always, what I do with them is not your business. What I do with you is your business. And you are to repent and believe. But also, we're being told what he's doing all the time in the big picture. And thence we're being told in chapter 45 what he's doing in this family to bring a rescuer to the world. The Bible doesn't take its time telling us the nitbits of what's going on in other families. But we know there were other families being rescued here, don't we? We know there were, because there were food in the food cities, and the Egyptians were coming, and people were coming from all over the world to get, as Joseph put it, to have their lives saved by the blessing of God. We don't know what's going on in Pakistan. We have only the terror bits to see. But in each individual family where there's a bereavement, I don't know. But I do know that the Bible tells me and tells us that what we should be praying for them is to come to know a Saviour who doesn't change. That's the message, actually. We're not to know the individual bits other than our own. And we are to know the big picture. And we must see, as we acknowledge that God is sovereign, that there is a big picture. And trust in the sovereign God who has brought us low, so that we can trust him. Most of all, because he sent a rescuer to the world. And as he's done that, you see, in chapter 45, we can see that because he's sovereign, his plan has been fulfilled, which is the third point. It's no wonder that, that Joseph and his brothers weep right there as he's told them, is it? They're weeping with joy, I'm sure. Once he's told them who he is, that's true. And they're weeping with sorrow. And maybe they're weeping for all those lost years, for all those times when actually they could have known him and loved him and enjoyed his presence and so on, but they didn't. And weeping for all those lost but necessary years. You see, the great danger is that you fall into the fallacy of believing that following God's plan means that life will somehow be easy in the short term. I come back to the point that it is a cult of our day to believe that we always have a right to be happy, always have a right to be comfortable, always have a right for everything to go well. We don't. We have a sovereign God who determines how we walk. And our obligation is to stick with him, no matter what happens. And sometimes, as was Joseph's experience, sometimes when you seek to honor God, actually, sometimes life will become very, very, very much more difficult. But in the long term, there is a goal, which is so much greater than anything we can ever conceive. Look back at the earlier chapters of Genesis, and you'll see and trace for a moment just what has happened. Just flick back to chapter 15 for a moment, so that we can appreciate just where Joseph sits in this plan. Chapter 15, all the way back with his great-grandfather Abraham, as he was then, about to be renamed Abraham in a few chapters' time. And the Lord said to Abraham in verse 13 of chapter 15, "Know for certain that your descendants will be strangers in a country not their own, and they will be enslaved and ill-treated for 400 years. Here in chapter 45, as Joseph and his brothers make this arrangement, and Joseph says, "Go get Dad and bring him here and bring everybody else as well." That's the start of the 400 years. Very quickly they find themselves enslaved, as we may or may not see if we go on into Exodus. If not, then read it yourself. This is the start of the 400 years. Can you see the point? That this is the plan of God being fulfilled. It was not an accident that Joseph was locked up. He was right. God sent him into Egypt. It was not an accident that he found himself in jail, being able ultimately to help in Pharaoh's court. And it's not an accident that his brothers beat him up, and now his brothers have been brought so low that they have to repent before their second youngest brother. It's not an accident. It's the plan of God being fulfilled. Chapter 45, verse 14. "Then he threw his arms around his brother Benjamin and wept. And Benjamin embraced him, weeping. And he kissed all his brothers and wept over them. And afterwards his brothers talked with him." I bet they did. You can imagine how the conversation went, can't you? "What have you done of these last 20 years?" "Well, I was tricked by my master's wife. And I spent about 15 years in jail serving the other prisoners. And then all of a sudden I had these dreams." And they said, "Dreams?" And he says, "Yep, more dreams. Only this time I was able to understand them." And so it goes on. "What have you done?" And Judah could say, well, "I saw both my evil sons killed by God. And then I defiled my daughter-in-law. And now I have two illegitimate children. But through it all I've learned that God is God." And Reuben and Simeon and the others could say the same. We don't know about Ben. But you can imagine the conversation, can't you? And finally, Pharaoh hears about the weeping. And now he hears about the brothers, verse 16. And it says he was pleased. And do you see what's happening there? As a pagan king has taken the warning of the sovereign God to prepare for a famine, so now the pagan king is thrilled that the plan of the sovereign God, not the God of the sun, not the God of the cat, but the God of the earth, the God who is there, the God of the universe, the pagan king is thrilled that the sovereign God's plan has been fulfilled. "So go get Dad," says Joseph. "We'll get the best of the land." And as you go, he says in verse 24, very realistically, "Don't quarrel on the way." You can see them, can't you? As they walk away, the "I told you so," says Reuben. "And it was all your faults," they say to Judah. "And see God in this," says Joseph. "Don't bicker. Trust in the sovereign God who has brought us to this state." And the story goes on, and I'm not going to read it again for you. We've already read it. Jacob is first stunned, and then he believes, and then he agrees to go. And verse 28, the very last verse of the chapter, sums up perfectly for us the whole situation. Because in it, Israel says, "I'm convinced. My son Joseph is still alive. I will go and see him before I die." How does it sum up the whole situation? Because of the name that is used for Jacob, that's how. Because right the way through the chapter, and through the previous chapter, bar one example, the name that has been used for Jacob is simply Jacob. But here, when the Bible wants to emphasize the faithfulness of God and the response to his sovereign hand and the recognition of his faithfulness and the leading of his goodness, it chooses to call Jacob Israel, which means, do you remember? he struggles with God. So he struggles with God, says, I'm convinced. Let's go. You and I don't need to struggle with God. Jesus has already done all of that for us on our behalf. We simply need to acknowledge that the times we need to be brought low to be raised up, and we need to trust in the sovereign God who has a plan to fulfill in our lives, and it will